This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: large-scale drone drills get underway across Iran, featuring scores of cutting-edge reconnaissance and combat UAVs. Plus, President Zelensky says Ukraine is aiming for victory and not peace, pledging to retake Donbass and Crimea from Russia. Also in our headlines, a former Twitter employee accuses a tech company of operating under poor privacy and security practices. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Iran has launched a large-scale nationwide drill involving dozens of drones and personnel from four branches of the military. The maneuver will cover strategic waters of the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman in the south to the eastern, western, northern, and central parts of the country. Ground, maritime, and air forces are taking part in the first-ever combined drill. More than 150 drones, including some jointly produced by the Defense Ministry and knowledge-based companies, will be put to the test for their control systems and combat capabilities. Earlier, defense officials said some other unmanned aerial vehicles used for reconnaissance missions will also take part in the maneuver. Iran has repeatedly said that its drills aim to boost the country's deterrent capacity. Iran's foreign minister says the country has preserved its political independence and succeeded in making economic and scientific progress despite the brutal sanctions. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comment in a meeting with Assimi Goita, the head of Mali's transitional government in Bamako. He said Iran is determined to develop defense, economic, trade, scientific, and technological cooperation with Mali. Goita, for his part, welcomed the expansion of bilateral ties. He praised Iran's achievements in the face of sanctions and its important status in global political and economic developments. He said people in Mali regard Iran as a role model and keep up their struggle against the excessive demands of foreign countries. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has reiterated his pledge to retake the eastern Donbass region and liberate the Russian-held territory of Crimea. In a recorded speech on Ukraine's Independence Day, Zelensky said his army is capable of defeating pro-Russian groups in the country's east. He also reprimanded Russia for its military offenses, saying, quote, "A Ukrainian nation was born with the Russian invasion on February 24th. He said Ukraine is aiming for victory, not peace. Donetsk and Luhansk together form the Donbass region, but declared their independence from Ukraine 2 days before the outbreak of conflict in February. Crimea voted overwhelmingly in a referendum to rejoin Russia in 2014. The fight over and across Donbass has long been the bone of contention between the two neighbors. Zelensky has promised to fly the Ukrainian flag once again over the regions now controlled by Russia or pro-Russian forces. And the United Nations urges parties to the Ukrainian conflict to immediately allow the International Atomic Energy Agency to inspect the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. During a Security Council meeting, the UN Undersecretary for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs said an urgent agreement is needed to reestablish the plant as a purely civilian infrastructure. The U.S. envoy called on Russia to immediately follow the UN recommendation and establish a demilitarized zone in the area surrounding the plant, which is in the control of Russian forces. Russia's envoy to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, said the IAEA mission to the site will take place in the very near future. He added that Moscow is ready to extend maximum support possible to resolve all organizational issues.
At the last meeting, not a single Western delegation had the courage to condemn the shelling of the station by the Ukrainian armed forces and ask the regime to stop it. We are under the impression that our colleagues exist in their own parallel reality in which the Russian military are themselves shelling the station that they are protecting and are using the American systems for that.
Russia and Ukraine have repeatedly accused each other of shelling the Zaporizhzhia facility. The plant remains close to the front lines, and attacks are raising fears of a nuclear disaster. The United States is to announce a new batch of military aid to Ukraine worth about $3 billion. This is Russia keeps warning about the consequences of weapons supply to Kiev. U.S. officials say the package is expected to be announced on Wednesday, which is the day the war in Ukraine hits the six-month mark and the country celebrates its Independence Day. This will be the single largest aid package to be received by Kiev since the war began on February the 24th. It will bring to nearly $14 billion the total amount of military assistance the Pentagon has offered ever since. Germany has also pledged a further $500 million military aid for Ukraine. Berlin's package will be delivered next year. It includes anti-aircraft systems, military vehicles, and rocket launchers. Russian officials say such shipments only add fuel to the fire of war and prolong the conflict. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett earlier joined us with his take on the latest situation in Ukraine.
People have gone really crazy. I mean, Zelensky and his Ukrainian hoods who are at the UN and their delusional propaganda about counteroffensives and being able to fight back against Russia and killing Russians everywhere they find them, including women and children and old people. This is truly the sign of a lunatic fringe that has lost its mind, and it resembles Hitler in the bunker in the last days of World War II. And I think they're going to come to that end. There is absolutely no hope of the Ukrainians busting out, doing a counteroffensive. They don't have the men. Three-fourths of their army has been destroyed. If you listen to other experts in the military field, Scott Ritter, Phil Guaraldi, Mike Maloof, General McGregor, all of us have analyzed this, and Ukraine is gone. It's dead, and it is a floundering shadow of what the Western media tries to portray it as. I think Russia is going to unleash a maelstrom of firepower and absolutely annihilate every one of these military forces of Ukraine in the next 6 weeks. I think Russia has retooled its military, it has rested, it has regrouped, and as a result of these latest episodes, Russia is about to engage in probably a more ferocious assault than we've seen for the entire war so far.
Twitter's former security chief has accused the communications company of misleading users and U.S. regulators about gaps in its security. Peter Zatko, in a whistleblower complaint, has claimed that American firm underestimated the number of fake and spam accounts. Zatko underlined that user data are vulnerable to hacks. The whistleblower has alleged that the company's security problems are a threat to the country's national security. Twitter has denied the accusation, saying that Zatko was dismissed for poor performance. The testimony could affect the company's legal battle with Elon Musk over his buyout bid. Musk, the world's richest man, has recently dropped his plans to buy the platform over its security problems. The former Louisville detective has pleaded guilty of providing false information to obtain a search warrant for Breonna Taylor's home that led to a 2020 raid in which the black woman was fatally shot. Kelly Goodall admitted to conspiring with another ex-detective to falsify the warrant and to making untrue statements to cover up the fake affidavit. Goodall faces up to 5 years in prison, a fine of $250,000, and 3 years of supervised release. Goodall and two other officers were facing federal charges for falsifying the warrant. This as a fourth was charged with using excessive force by opening fire during the raid. The killing of Taylor, along with the killing of George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery, among others, sparked outrage and galvanized protests that peaked in intensity in the summer of 2020. Yemeni officials say world bodies, including the UN, lack integrity and transparency in their humanitarian work in a war-torn country where millions of people struggle each and every day to get themselves some food. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports from Sana'a.
Yemeni officials criticize world bodies for lack of transparency in their humanitarian work in the conflict-stricken country. Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a on the occasion of the World Humanitarian Day.
The United Nations is in a state of weakness because it's subject to the conditions and dictates of donors, as it does not have its own resources. The United Nations has never proven its integrity despite receiving huge funds. If the UN is to be effective and impartial, it must have its own resources and grant everyone access to its financial reports, especially those who are receiving aid from the world body.
The ministry says world bodies must publicize their financial reports to prove their integrity. It says those world bodies receive billions of dollars every year from donors to save the lives of millions of Yemenis, but they're not doing much in this regard.
On World Humanitarian Day, we call on international organizations, including the UN, to increase transparency and integrity in their humanitarian activities in Yemen. Considering that many Yemenis have not seen the impact of their work and aid, there is massive corruption in international organizations, and therefore they must disclose their financial reports and explain to everyone how they spend what they get from donors.
Recently, the World Food Program said the cost of the minimum food basket has increased by 74%, and the prices of fuel have doubled across the country. The organization says this will push food insecurity in Yemen to new levels. Yemenis believe that world bodies, including the United Nations, want the war in Yemen be prolonged so they can ask for more funds for their programs. They say that international bodies have failed to ease the humanitarian situation in their country, despite the fact that they received huge funds to aid Yemen during 7 years of war and siege. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The UK Foreign Office has been urged to intervene after a PhD student of Leeds University was jailed in Saudi Arabia for sharing Twitter posts critical of Riyadh. The tweets have earned Saudi national Salman al-Shahab 34 years. Robert Carter reports.
The British government is facing calls to press for the freedom of a young woman imprisoned in Saudi Arabia over her use of Twitter. Salma al-Shahab, the 34-year-old mother of two, is a Saudi national who lived and studied in Britain before her arrest whilst visiting family inside Saudi Arabia in January 2021. Salma's original sentence was just 3 years, but earlier this month an appeals court extended her term, sentencing her to 34 years in prison, followed by a 34-year travel ban.
What's Salma's crime, you may ask? Just a series of Twitter posts and retweets, all of content critical of the Saudi regime. Her sentence is thought to be one of the longest ever doled out by the Saudi authorities against a female human rights activist inside the kingdom.
Activists and lawyers consider her lengthy jail sentence as shocking and outrageous, even by Saudi standards of justice. An opposition Labour MP, Hilary Benn, confirmed via a Twitter post he has sent a letter to Foreign Secretary and Tory leadership hopeful Liz Truss, demanding her intervention to help free the jailed student. As earlier this year, Truss declined to criticise the kingdom for its poor human rights record, saying Riyadh is an important partner of the UK. Critics express concern over not only Saudi rights abuses, but Western countries' double standards too.
I don't think the UK has that much influence at all if Liz Truss is going to try her hand. Of course, what we are seeing is the usual Western double standards. Only a few days before this horrific prison sentence was issued, Joe Biden was standing up for Salman Rushdie and saying that he had a right to free speech, and this was very much part of American values. But obviously those American values don't extend to Salma al-Shahab.
Ever since Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has become even more intolerant of any internal criticism and activism, jailing activists, bloggers, intellectuals and others for their political activism. International condemnation has done little to stop Saudi's behaviour, including the brutal killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in 2018. Robert Carter, London.
Well, hundreds of Lebanese people staged a rally in the capital Beirut to mark the 40th anniversary of resistance movement. Hezbollah, on the occasion, Hezbollah leader Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance will do its best to protect Lebanon and continue its support for the Palestinian people. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, reports.
Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has highlighted the stance of the resistance front in addition to the significant achievements accomplished in the past 40 years.
One of our duties in the future is to strengthen the strategies of deterrence to protect Lebanon's people, land, state, sovereignty and dignity, and natural resources and treasures.
The most pressing matter awaiting the resistance, he said, was the issue of maritime resources.
The main and current challenge that we're facing now and the few upcoming days is the issue of gas and petrol and the demarcation of the maritime borders. I will not say anything new. We have said everything that we should say. Now we're all waiting. The Israelis are talking and threatening, but we should wait and see.
The cause of Palestine was also a very significant endeavor, which Hezbollah sees as a duty of the past, present, and future.
In the last 40 years, we always believed in Palestine and the Palestinian resistance. We were dutifully supporting it, and we declared that openly and supported it in all forms, in the media and in politics. We have always declared that we stand by the side of the Palestinian people and the holy sites.
Celebrating 40 years since it was founded as a resistance movement, Hezbollah organized a mass rally where artists used hologram technology to commemorate the movement's martyred leaders. Those attending stressed that if it weren't for the resistance, they would not be here today.
The passion they had, the religious that it was in their heart, that made them believe that they can take care of us, of our lands, of our everything. Without them, we are nothing.
The celebration included real footage of past operations during the Israeli occupation of Lebanon, the liberation of most Lebanese land in May of 2000, as well as significant images from the 2006 summer confrontation of the Israeli assaults, and finally the fight against Takfiri terrorists in the eastern border mountains.
Hezbollah says it's celebrating more than a mere date on the calendar as its establishment day. 40 years ago today, the Israeli army, backed by multinational forces, occupied the capital, Beirut. But here, a group of young men believed liberation was possible and achieved the unthinkable. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The flagrant human rights violations, the wars, and the near-constant bombardments in Gaza, coupled with Israeli regime's 15-year-long blockade there, and the havoc the regime troops wreak across the West Bank, where violent raids are the norm, have made our lives extremely hard, our fates precarious and our futures uncertain, says Qada al-Haddad, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "Why is the world so indifferent to Gaza? Stay tuned for more. Adal Haddad, Gaza-based journalist, recounts her experience in Gaza. It was around afternoon prayers when my sister called to warn us that there was escalation, that the situation looked dangerous. "Take care of yourself," she said in a trembling voice. "War again," sighed my nephew, just 16, she said. Her family was supposed to pay a visit to her aunt to congratulate her on her daughter's Taujihi or high school results, which had been announced 2 weeks earlier. That was the plan, but plans in Gaza turned to dust, just like the buildings the Zionist regime bombs, and the bombing started on that Friday, August 5th. For the next few days, they lived in a far too familiar emergency. All of a sudden, they had to cancel all the plans. They decided to stay at home. Her brother turned the radio on. She hates the radio. It's always bad news. She turned it off. Her brother turned it on again. She escaped to social media. All her friends' news feeds were filled with fearful posts about what was coming. Above them all, the drones started hovering and buzzing. The anxiety-inducing soundtrack became louder and louder. Several of her nieces and nephews were around. They leaned to listen to their conversation. One asked, "How many wars have you witnessed?" At first I thought they were joking. They weren't. Came one answer, "Two wars." Came another, "All the wars." "All wars except one." It was one when the 2014 war happened. How strange it is that Gazans measure their age by the number of wars they have witnessed. Or rather, how strange it is not, having lived through repeated wars without any chance to recover from trauma leaves emotional scars. People are angry. People grow anxious. There is depression. There is substance abuse. And they ask questions that come from such bitter experience. Will it last as long as the 2014 war? Will it be short but deadly like the 2012? Will it be like 2021? War, no matter how long or short, is war. Comparisons fail to convey that all wars are, in a fundamental sense, the same. As it turned out, but how were they to know? The war this time lasted 3 days. But it was still war. War is about losses. It is about death and destruction. War is fear. War is anxiety. War is helplessness. War is horror. This one showed yet again their inability to protect themselves, their families, and their loved ones, and the brutality of the fake regime of Israel. The UN confirmed the total of 46 Palestinians dead, including 17 children. Gaza's Ministry of Health reported 360 injured, including at least 151 children, 58 women, and 19 older persons. More questions. Are Gazan lives so cheap that no one cares for them? Why is the world so indifferent to what is happening to Gazans, but so angry about Ukraine? The flagrant human rights violations, the wars, and the near-constant bombardments in Gaza, coupled with the Zionist regime's 15-year-long blockade there, and the havoc Israeli regime troops wreak across the West Bank, where violent raids are the norm, have made the Gaza people's lives extremely hard, their fates precarious, and their futures uncertain. Nights are the worst. In war, night strikes fear into their heart. All of a sudden, short summer nights become unbearably long. Nights are for death. It was just after nightfall that Gaza people heard about the Rafah massacre that killed 7, one of them just 13. Nights are for fear. 1.5-year-old nephew of Gadol Hadad will not stop jumping around, whether off the sofa or climbing in the kitchen or running. For that, they call him Monkey. He was startled one time when a loud explosion struck nearby. Ada held him close. She could feel his heart pounding in his tiny body. It is said that you own the future. This may be true of the rest of the world. People in Gaza own nothing, not even tomorrow night. The ceasefire brokered by Egypt and the UN came into effect on August 7th, 2330 local time. They were expected to go back to normal as if nothing happened. They are supposed to just cope with the trauma, the fear, the unemployment, the poverty, the insecurity, the lack of any future, the lack of options because of the Zionist regime's blockade. What is normal in Gaza? There are no jobs, there is no freedom of movement, there are no prospects. Electricity is rationed, the water is contaminated and scarce. Normal. They checked up on all their relatives. They offered their condolences to those grieving. They know this is not the last time Palestinian blood will be shed so cheaply.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Iran has once again raised alarm bells over Israel's nuclear stockpile, saying that it must destroy its nuclear weapons. It has also criticized the UN over the lack of progress for the 2010 action plan on the Middle East free of nuclear weapons. Why would the UN not see this as a case for alarm, yet it declares an emergency the nuclear risk posed by Ukraine's conflict, which involves nuclear-powered U.S. and Russia? Why has there been an acceleration towards nuclear weapons as a whole, especially by the U.S.? Just a few of the angles we will be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests for this program. Independent international affairs analyst Gilbert Doctorow joins us from Brussels. Also professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Daniel Kobalik joins us from Pittsburgh, PA.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I will first start with you, if I may, Daniel Kovalik. And let me just overall put the setting to you in the form of a question, and that's this 10th review conference of the parties to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which is held at the UN in New York. Why do you think there's a conference that's taking place? What is the purpose of it?
Well, I think there is a growing concern that the world is reaching the brink of nuclear war, particularly in the Ukrainian theater. And I think the nations of the world are fearful that, you know, if we don't move back from that brink, we're going to face it. So I think that's what's happening. And I hope the cooler heads prevail. You know, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists has said we've never been closer to nuclear war than we are now. And that appears to be true for a number of reasons. And, you know, so finally some nations are trying to confront that problem.
Well, we're looking at, if I could do a flashback here, Gilbert Doctorow, 1995, when you had the NPT Review Conference, adopted a resolution on the Middle East, and one of the things that it did was call on states to take practical steps in order to make overall the region free of nuclear weapons, basically, weapons of mass destruction. If we agree on that, then why is Israel the sole possessor of nuclear weapons in the Middle East? Why has there not been any progress towards either membership of the NPT or for Israel to get rid of its nuclear weapons or warheads?
Well, I think the unrestricted, unlimited backing of the United States with regard to Israel and its nuclear as well as other military and foreign policy decisions renders it impossible to achieve progress on this very issue in the Middle East. I understand the position of the Iranian diplomat in calling for a nuclear-free Middle East, and it's a very worthwhile objective. But as a practical matter, given the first point I made about U.S. backing, I don't think that it is productive of or to lead to progress, just as we're now closing in on a possible implementation or re-implementation of the Joint Comprehensive Action Plan.
Well, I'm trying to understand the logic. This has been something that's been hashed out before, Daniel Kovalik. But based on what our guest there says, it's mainly because of the U.S. that Israel, and there hasn't been any progress towards Israel either joining the NPT, which we're going to talk about also, nor for Israel to denuclearize its warheads, for example. How is it that the U.S. being one of the top possessors of nuclear weapons backs Israel in order for it not to get rid of its nuclear weapons, and that's enough for the world to say, well, that's okay, where you have the U.S. being that obstacle?
Well, hypocrisy.
Yeah, this is for Daniel Kovalik. I'm sorry, Doctor. Okay. I'll get back to you. Go ahead, Daniel Kovalik.
Yeah, well, obviously it is strange that the world has tolerated that. Of course, Israel is a nuclear state, but it's an undeclared one. That is to say, everyone knows it has nuclear weapons, but it has never declared that it has them. And I suppose that gives it a fig leaf of deniability. But, you know, all I can say is that it's totally unacceptable that Israel has these weapons. It's the only country in the Middle East that does. And it's unacceptable that the world has allowed that to happen without any sanctions at all. And, you know, equally unacceptable and bizarre that, you know, there's so much hand-wringing about whether or not Iran will or won't develop nuclear weapons. And then you have Israel that we know already has certainly 100 nuclear missiles, maybe as many as 200. You know, this is the double standard that prevails in the world. Sadly, the U.S. believes that it and its allies are above international law.
Well, Gilbert Doctorow, in terms of the numbers, again, Israel has neither admitted nor has said anything about possession of it, but it is estimated to be around 200 to 400. Again, we're not sure, but those are the estimates that have been given out there. Former U.S. president said that definitely Israel has nuclear warheads. And you talked about this implementation that's the may take place or may not, but if it does, how can then Israel, on what footing can it then come out making threats against Iran and the U.S. backing it, even though the U.S. is part of the countries that is going to maybe or maybe not come on board or re-enter this agreement? How can Israel be taken seriously then when it comes to Iran's case, for example?
Well, I think we have to start with the observation that hypocrisy is the small change of diplomacy. The fact that everyone knows about Israel's capabilities but pretends they don't is not particularly surprising. In the case of the real strategic situation in the Middle East, I'm skeptical that Israel's possessing nuclear weapons ensures its viability at the present state of armaments and the relative power of its neighbors. It's a very small country, it's a very limited geography, and even conventional explosives, which are now much more effective than they were 20 years ago, even conventional explosives could wipe the country off the map. So I think the urgency in terms of ensuring the stability and the security of neighbors is less a factor than it was 20 years ago, even if they've raised the number of their nuclear missiles from 100 to 200 or 200 to 400. It doesn't change the fact of the neighborhood.
The NPT is something that I mentioned a couple times, Daniel Kovalik, the textbook definition of it, based on its website, or the UN, I should say, is that it's a pillar of international peace and security and the heart of the nuclear disarmament and nonproliferation regime. Okay, if Israel doesn't want to say how many nuclear warheads it's had, why doesn't it want to join the NPT nor have any inspections on the facilities that actually have a weaponization program in place?
Well, again, Israel does not want to be held accountable. It wants to hold other countries accountable, but it doesn't want itself to be held accountable. And again, the U.S. takes the same position. And so at the end of the day, if the U.S. doesn't force Israel to comply with inspections or other measures, they simply won't have to. Again, in the end, the U.S., because it's such a strong military power, essentially it does what it wants in the world, and everyone else has to suffer what they will. Meanwhile, it just should be pointed out, you know, that the concerns about Iran seeking nuclear weapons, you know, I believe has always been really just a pretext. It's not really about their nuclear weapons. Of course, we know that both supreme leaders Iran has had have issued fatwas against nuclear weapons, and intelligence sources that have spoken on this have said that they're not trying to get nuclear weapons. It's all about molesting Iran, right? It's just trying to find a pretext to keep pressure on Iran, keep sanctions on Iran, possibly to invade Iran at some point. And so the nuclear weapons issues is really, it's a red herring. And I think it has to be understood as such.
But in that context, when we take a look at it, we're going to get off the Israel-Iran thing. It's my last question, I promise, because our topic is much wider than that. But when we take a look at the way that Israel has actually approached Iran on this issue, it hasn't been just a matter of being vocal about it. Nuclear scientists have been assassinated. Nuclear facilities have actually been struck. And that's something that is continuing. So on top of the fact that Israel has repeatedly attacked Syria, and we look at what's happening in the occupied territories, there's high risk of Israel in possession of nuclear weapons to react and maybe consider its use. Do you think that that is something to be alarmed about, Gilbert Doctorow?
Well, I think the security situation of Iran has changed dramatically since the start of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. The likelihood of anyone attacking Iran has diminished proportionate to the new backing and support, economic and military, potentially, that Iran is receiving in its agreements with both China and Russia. So the Iran can very easily discuss at diplomatic levels the behavior of Israel and how it is not in keeping with a nuclear-free Middle East. Iran can repeat, and I think with sincerity, its desire not to become a nuclear power, knowing that it has friends today and is not in the isolation and the pariah situation that it was 10 years ago. As I said, the conclusion of these major agreements, economic and military, with China and Russia in the last few months has changed the security position of Iran dramatically.
Well, in terms of nuclear weapons as a whole, I'm sorry, but I keep using the U.S. as an example. Russia is also somewhat in the same boat. But this next question, Daniel Kovalik, which started during the Obama administration, is this $1 trillion of what was announced, a nuclear weapons renovation program. And if you read through the lines there, there's a lot of, I'm not too sure, where the line gets blurred of the profitability behind this figure in order to move ahead with what they have used overall as a renovation program for the nuclear weapons. Do you think that is necessary? Doesn't that endanger the world more when something like that is in process?
Well, of course. I mean, I think the world community has always recognized that testing nuclear weapons or, again, engaging in this sort of massive renovation is itself a form of intimidation. It's actually using nuclear weapons. You're not firing them, but you're making the world know that you're prepared to fire them and want to be prepared to fire them. And I think it's very clear what the message that the U.S. is sending by this is that it wants a first strike capability. And we've heard various officials say just that, that they want to have the capability of wiping out another country and not, you know, being attacked in return, which, of course, gives an incentive for the U.S. to use nuclear weapons. So I think it is putting us in a very dangerous situation. Let me also say, as someone who lives in the United States, that to spend $1 trillion on that, when you have growing homelessness in this country, a lack of health care, a pandemic that continues to surge, is the height of irresponsibility and immorality.
When I was looking for the figure, Gilbert Doctorow, for the U.S., I had $2 trillion in mind. And every time I put that figure with a Google search, simple Google search, it came up with renovation for the U.S., bridges and roads, things of that nature, until I said $1 trillion, and there it came with the nuclear thing. Never mind that. What was your impression when you heard that the U.S. just tested a ballistic missile by the name of Minuteman III, which is said to be capable of hitting targets worldwide?
Well, testing is one thing. Manufacturing is something else. Coming back to the question of the trillion in renovating the nuclear arsenal in the United States, the fact is that today Russia has a more modernized nuclear stock than the United States does. It has not tested rockets that are undergoing testing. It has missiles that are already in production and being deployed, which are 8 Mach. They are hypersonic. And it has, as I mentioned at the outset, a high capability of conventional warheads of immense destructive capacity. So as it is today, but besides that, apart from the intercontinental missiles, and Russia has by far the largest inventory of tactical nuclear weapons, which have a very direct impact on the current power situation in Europe. Namely, NATO might be able to muster perhaps 1 million men at Russia's borders within a half a year or a year, but all of that would be destroyed in minutes by deployment of these tactical nuclear weapons. None of this is likely to occur. And I want to step back 1 minute. The United States has not dared to touch North Korea, which had maybe one or two nuclear weapons. The notion that America will achieve security and can bully the world by investing this $1 trillion is total nonsense. I'm sure that some arms manufacturers will do well out of it. The American public will be paying through the nose in higher debt repayment for decades to come. But in real security of America's national interest, it will do nothing to alleviate a situation that is adverse to America today and is likely to stay adverse for a decade or two because of the ingenuity and commitment and patriotism and boldness and guts of Mr. Putin's Russia.
When we take a look at the way that the risk of a nuclear war has been raised because of the Ukraine conflict, Daniel Kovalik, how much should we fear, do we really need to fear, that there will be a U.S. nuclear exchange with Russia on this?
Well, I don't fear that there's a huge likelihood of any intentional exchange of nuclear weapons. The fear I have is an accidental one, that either, you know, one side misreads the other, thinks the other side has fired a weapon, or maybe one of the sides accidentally fires one, and there's a return, and then you have a full-blown nuclear war. I mean, that's always been the fear. Of course, that we've come close a couple times. We know this. To such an accidental war, if that's what you want to call it. And yeah, that's my big fear, that could happen. Again, especially because you have a conflict, you know, a hot conflict now between Russia and Ukraine, and of course you have nuclear facilities that are at stake in all that. Russia is at high alert to use nuclear weapons. And so, yeah, I mean, the chance of something happening, something bad happening, I think, is very, very great.
Do we need to worry about not only Russia here, but also China, Gilbert Doctorow, in terms of an upcoming conflict that many are predicting between the U.S. and China?
Of course, that is a similar risk to what my colleague just described in the confrontation between the United States and Russia. That is an old type of confrontation and has certain traditions. The current conflict that is growing with China has no such tradition, and of course errors can be made. Unless the United States does something unbelievably stupid, and of course it's entirely possible because the United States policy has been remarkably self-defeating by taking a two-front, by raising the prospect of a two-front war, a war with both China and Russia at the same time. Unless they do something remarkably stupid, like running their aircraft carrier fleet through the Taiwan Straits and doing something obnoxious to any Chinese jets that harass them, I think that will not happen. For the reason I said above, if the United States did not dare to use its nuclear hammer against North Korea, which had an insignificant nuclear capability, then I think we can say safely that the United States is a bully and that bullies by definition are cowards. The American foreign policy is defined by cowardice, and therefore the eventuality as you described is most improbable.
Would you describe Israel the same way, Daniel Kovalik, in a minute?
Yes, I mean, I see that as well. I don't see a likely confrontation, nuclear or otherwise, between the U.S. and China in the near term. Though I do think in the medium to long term, there are leaders in the U.S. who may want such a confrontation. I mean, the U.S. is desperate. The empire's collapsing. The society's collapsing internally, domestically. And, you know, when you have a wounded animal like that, it becomes very dangerous. And I think we have to confront that fact.
Thank you very much for that. Professor of International Human Rights at the University of Pittsburgh, School of Law, Daniel Kovalik. Gilbert Doctorow, thank you. Independent international affairs analyst from Brussels. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, the grandson of the esteemed and honorable Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards salvation and prosperity, the one who addresses Allah on the day of Ashura, saying, "In so many difficulties and sorrows, I have unburdened myself upon you and brought my grievances before you, O Allah. This is because I lean on you and I am inclined towards you. I tend towards no other." Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his words. Imam al-Hussein's words with Umar bin Sa'd. O son of Sa'd, woe unto you! Do you intend to fight me? Do you not fear Allah, to whom is your return? I am the son of whom you know. Do you not want to be with me? This is indeed closer to Allah, the Sublime. What are you insisting on? May Allah kill you at your home very soon and not forgive you on the day you are resurrected. By Allah, I hope you will not eat of the wheat of Iraq, but a little.
As-salamu alayka ya.
Dear audience, now let's listen to some parts of Ziyara An-Nahiya Al-Muqaddasa. Stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام على الحسين الذي سمحت نفسه بمهجته
Peace be upon al-Hussein, who sacrificed himself up to the last drops of the blood of his heart.
السلام على من أطاع الله في سره وعلانيته
Peace be upon him who obeyed Allah secretly and openly.
As-salamu ala man ja'ala Allah shifaa fi turbati.
Peace be upon whom Allah placed a cure in the soul of his place of martyrdom.
As-salamu ala man al-ijabatu tahta qubbati.
Peace be upon the one under whose dome answer to supplications is guaranteed.
السلام على من الأئمة من ذريتي
Peace be upon the one in whose descendants are the imams after him.
السلام على ابن خاتم الأنبياء السلام على ابن سيد الأوصياء
Peace be upon the son of the seal of the prophets. Peace be upon the son of the chief of the executors.
السلام على ابن فاطمة الزهراء السلام على ابن خديجة الكبرى
Peace be upon the son of Fatima, the radiant. Peace be upon the son of Khadija, the great.
السلام على ابن سدرة المنتهى السلام على ابن جنة المأوى السلام على ابن زمزم والصفا
Peace be upon the son of the lotus tree in the outermost boundary of heaven. Peace be upon the son of the garden of refuge. Peace be upon the son of Zamzam and As-Safa.
As-salamu ala al-murammali bid-dima. As-salamu ala al-mahduki al-khiba. As-salamu ala khamisi ashabi ahli al-kasaya.
Peace be upon him who was saturated in his blood. Peace be upon him whose tents were violated. Peace be upon the fifth of the people of the cloak.
As And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bayna sta'in. Sallallahu alayki wa abdillah. Assalamu alayki wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is an episode of the program Dialogue, and I'm Dr. Fakhr Rouhani explaining to you some aspects of the movement of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. When Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was in Karbala, he met Umar ibn Sa'd. Please note carefully that Umar ibn Sa'd was the commander of the Umayyad forces in Karbala. First of all, Umar ibn Sa'd had received the mission to go to other places in order to conquer other places. However, being dispatched to those other